This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we're going to do some employment law, workers' rights. I want to tell you, and I'm very pleased to tell you this, that this month, February 2012, marks the 28th year that Your Legal Rights has been on public radio, most of which have been on this station, KALW. And so I hope you enjoy the programming that we have this month and continue to enjoy the programming that we will have in the future. My guests on this program are employment law attorneys Nina Fendel and Miles Locker. They are authors of the fourth edition of California Workers' Rights, which is published by an entity of the University of California, which is the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment. It's a very large paperback book, and we will let you know how you might be able to get it if you like. It's a very reasonable price, and it's a very fine book. And if you are a worker, and probably even if you're an employer, it would be worthwhile to get a copy of this. My other guest is Malcolm Longeway. Did I pronounce it right,
yes.
Malcolm, finally? Malcolm is an investigator with the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And a little bit later in the program, for those of you who listen to us live, whether it's in the Bay Area or on the Internet at www.klw.org, I will give our local phone number for you to call in with your questions. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding is provided by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the Family Law Section of the State Bar, and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. We are going to start with my guest, Miles Locker, who in years past has been a guest of this program a number of times. He's going to give us some of the basic things about wage and hours issues. And Miles, welcome back to the program.
Why, thank you very
nice
much.
Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Well, all right. In terms of wage and hour law, there are some, you know, basic areas that I think it's important for employees and employers to be aware of. First of all, most basically, there's the minimum wage, which in California is a higher minimum wage than under federal law, $8 an hour. And in San Francisco,
California law is $8 an hour?
That's correct.
Okay, all right.
And in San Francisco, actually, there's a higher minimum wage than that. It's $10.24
mm-hmm.
an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Another area where minimum wage rights are much broader under California law than in federal law. And what that is under federal law, it's possible to average out the minimum wage over the period of the pay period. So, for example, if in a week a worker works 40 hours, you look at the total earnings that worker made, divide by 40, and if it comes out to more than the minimum wage, there's no minimum wage violation. State law is different. Under state law, there's no averaging out. So for an hourly paid employee, that employee must be paid no less than the minimum wage for every job that worker does, for each hour, mm-hmm. for each part of an hour that person mm-hmm. is working. So there are employers out there that, for example, will pay workers $15 an hour, $20 an hour for a particular task. And then they'll say, oh, but this other thing that you do, that's not productive. We don't pay for that at all. And that's unlawful under California law. Those workers are entitled to recover the minimum wage. And on top of that, they're also entitled to recover liquidated damages, mm-hmm. which is an amount in addition to the minimum wage.
And liquidated damages, how do you determine what that means? Is that the difference between what you should have gotten and what you didn't get? Is that what liquidated
yes,
damages are?
Basically, it's the unpaid minimum wages plus the interest
okay.
on the minimum wages.
Oh, and the interest.
Yes, so you're getting that once as mm-hmm. Recovery for the mm-hmm. amounts not paid, and then you're getting basically a doubling of that as liquidated damages.
Miles, you've referred both to federal and state law with regard to wages, minimum wage. How would a worker know whether or not the federal law applies versus the state law?
Well,
or would a worker need to know that?
Well, this is a very good thing for employees because employees are covered in California. A worker who is employed in California, who works in California, is covered by both California and federal law. And in most instances, the provisions of California law are more beneficial. Every once in a mm-hmm, while, there's mm-hmm. a provision under the federal law, the Fair Labor Standards Act, that may be more beneficial, and the worker is covered by whatever is most beneficial to the
mm-hmm,
employee.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Overtime, for example, is another area where there are much stronger protections under California law than federal law. in terms of just generally overtime law, there are two main requirements that you have. Number one, the employee must be paid on a salary basis. So in order to be exempt from overtime.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a situation where a worker is being paid hourly and is being deducted from his or her pay for not working a full week, that generally is inconsistent with being exempt from overtime, and that employee is going to be entitled to overtime pay. In California, there's a minimum salary requirement that worker must be getting on a salary basis at least $33,280 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's just one part of the test.
Mm-hmm.
The next part of the test, and this is a very significant difference between state and federal law, is under California law that employee to not be entitled to be exempt from overtime, that employee has to be spending more than 50% of his or her work time actually engaged in tasks that are defined under the law as exempt tasks.
Mm-hmm.
So what you have is a situation where in many fast food restaurants and many retail stores, you have assistant managers or managers that are, and the employers say, oh, they're exempt.
Because
they're managing. But if these people are spending more than half of their time, frying up the burgers,
yes,
ringing up customer sales,
yeah,
putting merchandise out on the floor, there's no way that they're exempt from overtime. They would be entitled to overtime.
All right, and the overtime would be what, time and a half? Is that generally speaking the rule of thumb?
Under California law, the overtime is time and a half for all hours over 8 in a day, up to 12 in a day.
Mm-hmm.
It's double time for anything over 12 in a day.
Mm-hmm.
It's also time and a half for anything over 40 in a week.
Mm-hmm.
California has daily overtime limits on how much you can work in a day without getting overtime.
So in other words, if on one day you work 12 hours, but the rest of the week you only work 8 hours, mm-hmm, each day, you're still entitled, or let's say you only worked 4 hours on one of the days, so it all works out to be 40 hours. Still, that 12-hour day, that person is entitled to time and a half.
4 hours of overtime,
yeah,
time,
okay,
and a half, correct.
All right. Let's do this. There's so much to talk about. It's really incredible. We haven't even touched upon meal periods, but what I want to do is let me go to Nina Fendel at this point. And Nina, why don't you talk a bit about some of the major issues in family leave, probably those issues that most people or a lot of people are not aware of in terms of their rights.
Thank you, Chuck. We've had an incredible explosion of rights in the area of family leave in the last 10 years. People tend to think of family leave as mothers with children, but these leaves are really much broader, and these rights are broader. So if you have a spouse who's very, very ill, if you're ill yourself and need some job protection, if your parent is ill or your child, if you need time to bond with a newborn child, even though no one's sick, you probably have very significant rights to take family leave.
What amount of time do you have, though, for family leave? The extent of the time, how much are you entitled to?
In general, if you're dealing with the situation where someone is ill,
mm-hmm,
you have 12 weeks of family leave, assuming that you work for an employer who is covered by the law.
And who is that? How is an employer covered by the law?
All public employees employed by any public agency are covered by the law. In addition, if you work for a private company or even a nonprofit, if the employer has 50 people within a 70-mile radius of where you work, and if you've worked there for one year, doesn't have to be full time, but you have to have put in at least 1,250 hours.
Mm-hmm.
That's about 25 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're covered and you have the rights to leave. Now, there are rights to take leave, job protected leave, meaning you can come back to your job or an equivalent job with health insurance paid during that time. That's one area of rights. The other area and the other question is, can you get paid for any of that time?
Mm-hmm.
I'm proud to say that California was the first state in the country to pass paid family leave. It's starting now to catch on in other states. I believe it's in about 7 or 8 states now.
So in other words, someone has the right to family leave, not not just to be able to maintain his or her job, but also to be paid during that period of time?
Here's how the rights to pay work.
All right.
We have a system in California called state disability insurance. It's a very, very good system. Employees pay for it. Not all public employees pay for it. Federal employees are not included, but almost every private employee is going to be covered. And you can tell if you're covered by it because on your pay stub, it will say SDI.
Okay.
And you'll have a small amount taken out. This is a public insurance policy, and it covers you if you get sick and can't work, if you have an immediate family member who is seriously ill and needs your attention. Also, we have in California 6 weeks for bonding with a newborn child. And the definition of family, immediate family in California, is also a little bit more expansive than you might think. It can be a biological child, adoptive child, foster. It can be a child that you are in charge of raising, even if you're not a parent.
Like a grandparent, you're saying?
If a grandparent is raising the child.
Really?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The same with parent. The definition of parent can be a step parent, an adoptive parent, or it can be someone who raised you as a parent when you were a child. And then you therefore have the right to take time off if they need help.
In your book that you have, the fourth edition of California Workers' Rights, that you, Miles Locker, and David Rosenfeld have put together, is there some details about the Family Leave Act in here?
There are, about the Federal Family Leave Act and also the California Family Rights Act.
And the same thing with wage and hours. Is there not, Miles, in the book you put together?
A lot of material.
This is a big book, but it has been designed, has it not, for the average worker?
That's right.
It's non-lawyer average worker?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's even good. Even a lawyer can understand this. I think because I looked at it and I could understand it.
We tried to write it so that anyone with a high school education could follow
it. That's wonderful.
Even a politician.
Now, wait a minute. That's going too far. I'm sure I'll hear something about that. I'm sure I'll hear something about that. Could you tell, if you would, Nina, could you tell those of us who might be interested in the book how they can get it?
Sure. They can go online at labourcenter.berkeley.edu, and they will find an order form there, and they can order it. And there is also a discount for quantity. We have a number of organizations who have ordered it for all of their staff or all of their offices.
Well, let me give it to you again. This is all essentially one word, lowercase, I presume. Labourcenter.berkeley.edu, and you will find a reference to California workers' rights and how you can order it if you'd like to. I'm a real believer. I think of those of you who listen to this program and have for a while, I'm a real believer in you educating yourselves in the law. Because I think that's how you get control of your lives, your legal lives. And I want you to know that I think that this is a very reasonable price for this book. It's $29.99, and I think that that's excellent. And, of course, it is published by one of the organizations at UC Berkeley, and that's how, obviously, it can be so reasonable. But there's a lot of stuff in that book. All right, let's do this. I want to give Malcolm a chance to talk a bit and then come back to some of these other issues if we can. Malcolm, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the federal commission, you're one of the investigators. What essentially does it do? Why is this important to workers generally?
The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission enforces the federal civil rights laws, which include Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990, as amended. I want to touch on that. I'll get back to it because it's been recently amended. Age Discrimination Act of 1967, Equal Pay Act of 1963, and one of the new ones, the Genetic Information Non-Disclosure Act, which we don't get a lot of charges for, but it's out there.
What does that mean?
That actually has to do with employers doing research into their employees' genetic history, or asking inappropriate questions that could lead to the reveal of genetic information, such as if the person has a history of cancer in their family or diabetes or something to that effect. So those sorts of questions being utilized to not hire people because they might have higher insurance rates, that's really there to protect.
So an employer is not allowed to look into that?
No, they're not. That's they're right. only allowed to look into things that would have a legitimate business necessity. And so that is one that is relatively recent, and mm-hmm. we haven't seen a lot of charges, but they're starting to pick up.
Very interesting.
So for Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, we're looking at sex, race, national origin, religion, color, of course, disabilities for the Americans with Disabilities Act, mm-hmm. and age. And Equal Pay Act is sex discrimination with wages, so it crosses over into wage and hour in a lot of ways. And retaliation for all of the statutes is also what we cover.
Retaliation, I'd like you to talk a bit about retaliation. What essentially are we talking about here? If for example, someone has a personality problem, let's say someone is doing a fine job, but the supervisor, for some reason, the supervisor and this employee personality-wise just don't get along. Right. And so the supervisor feels, you know, I just really don't want to deal with this person anymore. I just want to let him or her go. Is that retaliation?
No. Let me explain, because what you're touching on is talking about discrimination, but not in a way that's protected by the EEOC. A retaliation is if you've participated in protected activity under one of the statutes that we cover. There's retaliation mm-hmm. under other statutes. But for the EEOC, it is essentially making a complaint that is related to our statutes. For example, I believe I'm being discriminated against because of my sex, and you tell a supervisor mm-hmm. or human resources that type of information. And say you report your supervisor and say that, you know, I'm mm-hmm. a woman, mm-hmm. I'm being mistreated because of my sex by my supervisor.
You know, you're not talking about sexual harassment, or
no.
are you?
Okay. No, all right. No, not sexual harassment. Right. It's so, but that could be covered if okay. you say, if you all report right. your supervisor for mm-hmm. harassing you mm-hmm. and they're harassing you because of one of your protected classes, such mm-hmm. as sex or, mm-hmm. or race. And say your supervisor retaliates against you, is upset by the fact that you reported him, whether or not it was a misunderstanding mm-hmm. or if it was actually with merit, that supervisor cannot take a tangible job action toward you in a negative way. Mm-hmm. Unless, of course, it's for legitimate reasons. I mean, that's not saying that you can, you know, go and report your supervisor for discrimination mm-hmm. and then just stop showing up and mm-hmm. coming in late and then mm-hmm. say it's retaliation because they punish you for it. There's, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it has to be definitely related to the statutes. So filing a charge with EEOC, DFEH, that also is a protected activity. Participation.
Let me give DFEH, that's the Department of Fair Employment and Housing.
Yes,
that's the California office.
Yeah, it's okay. our sister organization yeah. For Civil Rights California. Mm-hmm. And or even participating mm-hmm. As a witness, mm-hmm. Somebody that's supporting someone who's making a charge of discrimination. It's becoming involved in the process in such a way that, you know, might make you a target.
Yeah.
And we want to make sure that people aren't made targets and punished for asserting their rights under our statutes.
If you have someone who believes he or she is a victim of discrimination, how soon must they file a claim with the EEOC for a complaint?
For here in California, we have a, as I mentioned, the DFEH sister organization mm-hmm. for states in that have an organization like that, what we call a FEPA, and those are 300 days. So for here in California, you would have 300 days from the date of the last discriminatory act to file with us.
And if you don't, what happens?
Then you unfortunately, your recourse for the EEOC is not there. Now, DFEH is 365 days, so that's important to know. If you run out on your time for the EEOC, you can oftentimes go to the DFEH and file with them. The other key thing is that we also have jurisdictional issues. We need to have 15 employees or more for Title VII and the ADA. For the Age Discrimination and Employment Act, it's 20 employees. The EPA, the Equal Pay Act, is actually one employee.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah. So if you have a predecessor that is of, an opposite sex than yourself, and that person was being paid more than you were for doing the same work and having the same experience and utilizing the same skills, you can file a claim saying that that was a violation of the Equal Pay Act.
And the EEOC, I take it, has various offices throughout the state.
Yes, we have an office in San Francisco, and there's an Oakland office, a San Jose office, and an L.A. office.
Let me do this because I think it's very important. We're really talking. There's so much to talk about in the area of employment law. Are there some websites that you would like to give that you feel are important to people to try to educate themselves, aside from the laborcenter.berkeley.edu to be able to look into getting a copy of California Workers' Rights? Are there some other websites that you'd like to refer to give people some idea of how they can educate themselves?
There are some very good websites on family leave. In order to investigate paid family leave in California, you can go to www.paidfamilyleave.
P-A-I-D, family leave.
All one word.
Yeah.
.org.
Paidfamilyleave.org.
They have up-to-date information. If you want more general information on when you can take time off and have your job protected as a form of family leave and get your insurance rights, go to www.las.elc.org. I'm going to tell you what that stands for so that it's easier to hear. It's Legal Aid Society dash Employment Law Center.
Now, is it dash L-A-S dash, is it?
Yes.
Okay, L-A-S dash E-L-C.org.
That's right. And they have some very good fact sheets on various kinds of pregnancy leave, family leave for your own health, family leave to care for family members.
And I have had some of the lawyers from that organization in San Francisco on the program.
They were great.
Yeah, they are. They're outstanding. Let me come back. Did you have something you wanted to tell us, some website, Miles, that you wanted to tell us about?
On wage and hour law.
Yeah, I'd like to know more about
certainly
that.
Certainly, the State Labor Commissioner has a website that can be accessed at www.dir.
D-I-R.
Stands for Department of Industrial Relations, .ca.gov.
Okay.
And once you get on that, click on the Labor Commissioner website, and a whole host of things will come up in terms of all the different laws that apply to California workers.
In terms of filing a complaint with the Department of Industrial Relations, if someone wants to do that, what is the time period on that?
It depends. A complaint with the State Labor Commissioner, workers have a choice in California. They don't have to exhaust their administrative remedy. They can file with the State Labor Commissioner, or they can file a private lawsuit with a private attorney. And there's pluses and minuses on both sides.
So you don't have to get permission from the State Labor Commissioner's office to be able to file an action with through a private attorney.
That's correct. Now, in terms of just general limitations periods for when an action must be started, either with the Labor Commissioner or in court with a private attorney, it depends on the nature of the claim. So if the claim is based on enforcing just a contract, the employer said, I'm going to pay you $20 an hour, but instead only paid me $15 an hour. If it's an oral contract, 2 years has to be filed within 2 years.
All right.
If it's a written contract, four years.
4 years. Okay.
If it's what they call a statutory claim, that is a violation of a state law, minimum wage, overtime, meal period rights, the right to be reimbursed for all necessary business expenses, that's a three-year statute of limitations. That's with the Labor Commissioner. Now, by going to a private attorney and filing a lawsuit in court, you would also add a different cause of action under the State Business and Professions Code, and that would extend you out another year.
What would that that code section be?
Business Professions Code, Section 17-200.
Which my office, as a deputy DA doing consumer protection, we're looking for businesses that are conducting unfair or unlawful business practices.
Yes, yeah. and they're unfair and unlawful both in the sense that the businesses that violate state law, wage and hour laws are not only harming the employees, but they're also harming legitimate employers that are trying to follow the law.
Of course, of course.
Miles, question for you, if I can
quickly go ahead,
ask
please.
That. So for wage and hour, if somebody is working at a job and they're not getting paid the amount that somebody else is working, and it's not discrimination, but they're, say, doing the same job duties as somebody else that's getting paid more and because they're a higher position, and essentially, I guess it would be called being working out of class. Mm-hmm. Is there something there for working out of class?
Well, here's the thing. You know, both in terms of the situation you're describing now, and also earlier you were talking about a situation where someone, let's say, is not the victim of retaliation for violating a law, but someone who's being treated unfairly by an employer who believes they got fired for no good reason. If that worker is covered by a union contract, if that worker is in a unionized workplace, there's going to be just cause provisions in that agreement, and that worker is going to be able to challenge being paid out of class or challenge being fired unlawfully. In terms of state law, you have to come under specific provisions that provide for either payment of a certain wage or that prohibit retaliation for engaging in certain activities that are protected under the law.
Time is going too fast. We have come to the end of the statewide version of the program. We continue on the internet at www.kow.org. We continue in the Bay Area. I'll give the phone number in just a moment. All right. It is 728 at 91.7, your local public radio station, KOW in San Francisco. I would just like to let you know that in case you've tuned in the last few minutes, we're doing a program on employment law. And frankly, if we were to do any justice to what you have to offer here, we need, I think, at least 6 hours. So all the rest of the programming on this station is canceled. We are going to go another 5.5. No, I'm just joking, everybody. Don't let me turn you off. All right, my guests are employment law attorneys Nina Fendel and Miles Locker. They are the authors, two of the three authors. The third author is David Rosenfeld, who unfortunately could not be here. They're the authors of the fourth edition of California Workers' Rights, which is published by the UC Berkeley Labor Center. My third guest is Malcolm Loungeway. He's an investigator with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. The book that we're referring to is called California Workers' Rights. It's a very fine, large paperback. I think it's something that if you are an employee and you feel you don't know what your rights may be, I would highly suggest that you might want to look into probably getting this book. You can go to the website, which is Labor Center. This is all one word, lowercase, laborcenter.berkeley.edu. And then look for the listing for California Workers' Rights. It's an excellent book, and I highly recommend it. Let me just give you our phone number, 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. I welcome you to call in with your question, your comment, whether you're an employee or an employer. Please, just because you're an employer, don't feel that group there on that program is against us. No, we're not. No, we're not. The idea is to educate the public about, and whether you're an employee or an employer, what the law is. By the way, for those of you who have tuned in a little bit late, I'm very pleased to say that this month is the 28th year that Your Legal Rights has been on the air. We started in 1984, exclusively funded by the State Bar as a State Bar project, State Bar of California. And, of course, now there are some sections of the State Bar that fund the program. The Board of Legal Specialization funds the program. This particular segment of Your Legal Rights is funded by the Labor and Employment Law section of the State Bar. The San Francisco Bar Association is one of the funders, the San Mateo County Bar Association also, and the California Applicants Attorneys Association, which deals with workers' compensation. So I hope that you have gotten something out of this program, and I thank all of you, by the way, who have been so supportive of KALW in these last week or so in helping the station to make its goal. It's terribly important to this station, considering how careful it has maintained itself as a public radio station without commercials. And I'm very proud of that. So here we go. Steve, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Great program. Happy anniversary from a longtime member. I think one thing that your program does so well is to be able to help people.
Well, that's the idea.
Could the guest talk about the ADA and what reasonable accommodations are? And
yeah.
Specifically, I've heard that you don't have to tell them when you're being interviewed or after, or even after being hired, about disability, but then it mm-hmm. could be down the line where you need an accommodation. And actually, it's a pretty broad spectrum under what falls under ADA.
Let me get some comments for
Great,
you on this,
you.
Steve. Yeah, thanks for calling.
Here.
Yeah, put your radio back
I got
up.
It.
Yeah, terrific. Thank you very much. Well, what about this? If someone does have a disability and it is not visible, to the prospective employer, what right does the employer have to determine whether or not this person may have a disability at that point? Or what obligation does the prospective employee have to tell the employer, by the way, I have a low back problem and every 20 minutes I got to get up, and I've got to walk around, et cetera.
Excellent question. Unseen disabilities.
I mean, can we sneak our disability? That's the point. That's my point.
You do not have to reveal a disability to an employer.
Okay.
You would only need to reveal a disability to an employer if you are requesting a reasonable accommodation for it. Reasonable accommodation can be, you know, you don't have to use any magic words. You mm-hmm. don't have to use the term reasonable accommodation. You can explain it just, you know, as you did, to say to your employer, hey, I have this lower back problem. I'm going to need an accommodation in that I need to get up and walk around every
Does the prospective employee then have to tell the employer that before being hired?
No. No, not before being hired. No, definitely. And as a matter of fact, the employer cannot ask disability-related questions before hire.
But after you are hired, if you've got the problem, you then as the employee can tell the employer, I have this low back problem, and if I don't get up every 20 minutes and walk around, I've got this terrible pain, and it really is very difficult to deal with. Mm-hmm. And the employee cannot be fired for that.
Correct.
That's good.
All right. The employer with a reasonable accommodation request can only deny it if it is an undue hardship. And under the ADA, undue hardship is very, how would I say, it's
very hard to show.
It's very hard to show.
Yeah.
It, of course, depends on the size of the employer and the resources of the employer and the like. And every single time a reasonable accommodation is requested, there needs to be an individual analysis. It can't just be, you know, you can never just say, hey, undue hardship because mm-hmm. it costs a certain amount. It needs to be analyzed. The employee has certain responsibilities as well, though. They need to provide the medical documentation that's necessary to, you know, show the employer that this accommodation is
this
necessary.
This would have to be from a medical doctor.
Correct.
Or someone who obviously would have the expertise.
Qualified medical examiner, a doctor, a psychiatrist, mm-hmm. if it is, mm-hmm. you know, a psychological yeah. disorder. And there needs to be, and this is key, and a lot of people don't know this that come into us, the accommodation given to the employee does not need to be the accommodation requested by the employee.
Oh, I see.
It just
as long as it's reasonable. As long as it's reasonable?
Reasonable for both parties, okay. And it has to work, and it has to be able to let the person perform the essential functions of the job. Mm-hmm. So, for example, just really quick, you know, I couldn't go in and say to an employer, I need to have a big Barco lounger because of the fact that I have depression. There needs to be some kind of a correlation there that a medical professional can establish, and the employer there needs to be an interactive process, but a give and take between their employee and the employer as to discussing, you know, the accommodation.
Any comments from either Nina or Miles? Okay, there's a caller called in a question. Let me pose this to you if I can. How can an employer in this instance, in a local subsidiary of a major shoe business, pay $6.71 per hour unless the worker has sufficient sales to raise the wage to the going minimum? Did you understand that? But apparently this employee is saying that he or she works for a local subsidiary of a major shoe company, and the pay is $6.71 per hour unless the worker has sufficient sales to raise the wage to the going minimum. So here's this little person who's, you know, doing certain work but is only getting $6.71.
Well, as a general matter, that
and this is a major company, by the way. I won't tell you what it is,
right?
But it's a major company.
As a general matter, that would be completely illegal.
Mm-hmm.
That an employer can, you know, that even when a worker is paid on a piece rate basis or a commission basis, even if the employee's wages are tied to his or her productivity, you can't go below the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there may be, though, there's one exception to the minimum wage, and that's in the case of employees who are considered to be outside salespeople.
Not
independent contractors. Oh. Outside salespeople are employees, and they're entitled to other rights that employees have, such as, for example, they are entitled to reimbursement of business expenses that they pay. But for someone to be considered an outside salesperson, they have to be spending more than 50% of their time away from the employment premises engaged in selling.
So that would be like we know the old Fuller Brush man who's going door to door trying to sell brushes. This is what you're talking about.
Yes.
That kind of an example, which I hope most of you are old enough to know what I'm talking about. I suspect this audience is. Okay. All right. So we've covered that one.
Yes.
For the time being. Now, this person who is being paid $6.71, what recommendations would you suggest to him or her? To whom should he contact?
Well, this person really has a choice. Can either go to the state labor commissioner and file a wage claim at a local office of the state labor commissioner. There are about 20, 25 offices located throughout the state.
Throughout the state. Mm-hmm.
Yes, here in the Bay Area, there's an office in downtown San Francisco, another one in downtown Oakland, one in downtown San Jose. And they could do that. Another alternative would be to seek out a private attorney. This is something certainly that my firm does. And particularly in a situation where if it's not just that one individual, but it's a group of several people who are being treated the same way, then, you know, you have the ability to file a class action against the employer and really, you know, try to bring about justice for a whole group of workers.
Miles, if I may for just a minute, Nina, and then come right back to you if you don't mind. If this person is just one person and he or she is doing this on his own, going to a private attorney, what can that worker expect to be confronted with? Well, you're going to have to pay me on an hourly basis or what generally can the employee expect?
You know, each situation is different and a lot of the work that I know my firm does, for example, mm-hmm. is contingency-based work.
Okay. So if you're successful, you get something out of a percentage out of whatever
exactly.
the result is. Okay.
So the most important thing for a worker like that is to start exploring different options,
if the worker files a claim or complaint with the Labor Commissioner's Office, there is no charge, is there?
That's a free process.
Yeah, free. Okay. All right. In your opinion, and I know you used to be the major attorney at the Department of Labor or the Labor Commissioner's Office, what's the situation, as far as you know, regarding what the volume is and what can a worker expect in terms of, am I going to see any results in 6 months, 9 months, or is it going to take years? I mean, I'm sure you have still a feel for this. What's the problem there, if there is?
the problem there is the number of claims coming in. The caseloads are gigantic.
No kidding.
Unfortunate. In a typical year, there are statewide 50,000 wage claims filed with the State Labor Commissioner's Office, and the staffing has not kept up with mm-hmm. the amount of cases coming in.
Yeah.
They're doing the best they can, and it's a very critical service for workers because there are cases that even attorneys who, really are not in it for the money, who want to represent low-wage mm-hmm. workers, they're just cases that economically...
You can't handle.
Exactly.
Too bad. That's too bad. Nina, you were going to say something.
I wanted to follow up on Miles' suggestion of talking to one's trusted coworkers. It's mm-hmm. a very, very good idea to deal with trusted coworkers in this kind of situation where you may all be experiencing the same deprivation of rights. Mm-hmm. Because once you do that, you also get the protection of labor law. You are protected under labor law for what's called concerted action, which means a group of employees. It can be two, mm-hmm. but more than one. A group of employees talking about and contemplating and taking action mm-hmm. on deprivations of rights or issues around their working conditions. So you're much more protected if you're working with a group of employees than you are if you're just out there by yourself.
All right, let me let you know, this is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're doing a program on workers' rights. My guests are Malcolm Loungeway, an investigator with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the Federal Commission. Also, employment law attorneys Nina Fendel and Miles Locker. They are the authors of the fourth edition of California Workers' Rights. It's a large paperback book published by UC Berkeley Labor Center, an outstanding book. I highly recommend it to you to look into. You can go to the website and find out more about it at laborcenter.berkeley.edu. All right, our number, 1-415-841-4134, 1-415-841-4134. And Tommy, welcome to the program. Tommy,
hello.
This is the lady, Tommy. Huh? Go ahead, Tommy.
My question is about disability rights also. My daughter is working really hard to be able to work. She's had to drop down to 4 days a week and every year has to take the family medical leave to get her body back into shape. But the question is, how does one get oneself identified as disabled so that the Americans with Disabilities Act accommodations can be requested?
Very interesting. What condition, if I may ask, does your daughter have that so makes
there it? There are two conditions that work together. Well, three conditions that work together, and then when she was at work, because of some of those, of one of those conditions, her body was further deconditioned, and so now there are even more problems.
Wow. How old is she, Tommy?
She's 30 and really struggling.
Tough. Mm. Well, let me get some comments for you. This is very, very difficult, obviously, for your daughter. What thoughts does anyone have here? You want to start?
Well, the first thought that comes to mind is that As of 2009, the Americans with Disabilities Act has been amended to make it much easier for someone to be identified as a qualified individual with a disability. This used to be the hot topic for debate in the courts regarding the ADA, is that first prong of the prima facie elements of proof, which is charging party is a qualified individual with a disability, and the courts would continually get hung up on the term qualified and the terms individual with a disability because a lot of things were not considered to be disabilities. That has eased.
Mm-hmm.
From the EEOC standpoint, we at this point are looking a lot less at that first prong and doing a lot of assuming arguendo that the person is an individual mm-hmm. with a disability, that and mm-hmm. moving on to the prongs later.
How can Tommy and her daughter go about educating themselves a bit more in terms of, obviously on this radio program, we don't have enough time to go into all the details, but what is it that Tommy and her daughter may look to that might help them to better educate themselves?
The Job Accommodation Network, JAN, is what it's called. It's online.
J-A-N.
It is it's a organization and website that talks about best practices for employers, but it also gives good advice to employees as to how to approach the subject, and goes into their rights and possible accommodations and the like.
What do you know the website on it?
No, okay. Not off the top of my head.
JAN stands for Job
Accommodation Network.
Okay, so if you Google that,
yes,
presumably you will find the email. Go ahead, if you would.
One of the most common mistakes workers make when they seek reasonable accommodation is that they often have no medical backup.
Right.
That's
okay.
A serious problem.
Yeah.
So you have to go to your doctor or find a doctor who will cooperate with you. Now, you don't have to reveal the diagnosis. Sometimes it's strategically wise to reveal the diagnosis.
Sometimes it is wise.
Yeah. Sometimes I think it is, because mm-hmm. it helps employers be more compassionate and understand mm-hmm. that you're not malingering.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's really something going on. Mm-hmm. But the medical provider has to say, this person has a disability, they're prevented from doing this unless they have this type of accommodation. So a patient who's going to a doctor to have this conversation ought to think through what are the requirements of the job, what do they need help with, mm-hmm. what mm-hmm. kinds of help do they need, and they ought to come in with some type of ideas to suggest to the doctor.
To the doctor,
and they
so
ought
the
to
doctor
get
can
that.
Write an appropriate letter.
That's right, and okay. they ought to bring that letter with
okay.
them
right.
when they talk to the employer. The other thing is sometimes line supervisors do not understand these rights.
Yes.
And if it's a company mm-hmm. that's big enough to have a human resources department, don't stop with the supervisor.
Right.
Go to human resources.
Right.
They are more educated in these rights.
Can I ask Tommy
clarifying? What if the individual has asked for these accommodations, one of which, for example, I've learned that there are no, one piece that really is aggravating her situation is the complete lack of ergonomics. She has to stand up for 8 hours a day with a screen and a keyboard down at thigh high. And work at it, you know, all day long,
mm-hmm.
and they're refusing to change that in any way. So what happens when those kinds of things happen? I mean, she has a doctor working with her. She has a doctor that has requested various things, but she's not getting any.
How big is the employer, Tommy? How many employees?
It's part of a chain.
So it's a big employer. Okay.
Are they refusing, or are they just taking an exceptionally long time?
No, they're refusing.
Hmm.
They don't want the computer to be able to be seen by customers, so they want it to be low. And she can temporarily sit sometimes, but the other piece with that is that then the knees hit up against the doors and the handles and all that kind of stuff. So, but she's not allowed to do that for long periods of time. I mean,
I think Nina has something further for you, Tommy.
In the orders of the Industrial Welfare Commission, which set a lot of the rules for working in California, number 14 says all working employees shall be provided with suitable seats when the nature of the work reasonably permits the use of seats. Mm-hmm. Now, if they want the computer hidden...
there are screens.
There are screens. There are all kinds of ways
sure.
to do that.
I mean,
that,
this is silly.
That are not expensive.
Just silly.
Send her over. I'll talk.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, this is just, it sounds, Tommy, just outrageous for this employer. So good luck to you and your daughter.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Take care. All right. Here's a question, and then we're going to get to Carol in just a minute. And this is another very good question. And this is very interesting. Is the employer obliged to apply the same disciplinary standards to workers who are union members versus workers who are not organized? Don't you love it? In other words, might it be discrimination when the employer holds one yardstick to discipline the union worker, a different yardstick when the employee doing similar work is a management worker? Okay, Miles, well, there you go.
That's a great question.
Yeah, it's a good one. Is this a law professor who sent this in here? Okay, go ahead.
This is why the law has all these shades of gray in it, because of the answer I'm going to give you.
Now, that's getting scary. Well, now, wait a minute
it
here.
Does. Because it is unlawful for an employer to basically discriminate either in favor of or against union workers or non-union workers in terms of how the employer might discipline for certain infractions. But by the same token, if you have a group of, let's say, a segment of a workforce, perhaps different subsidiaries or whatever, different divisions of a workforce, and one division is happens to be unionized, it's organized, it's a bargaining unit, mm-hmm. And in that, as a result of that, those workers have negotiated a collective bargaining agreement with the worker.
They've got some power.
They do.
Power. Yeah.
And that collective bargaining agreement provides certain rights for them mm-hmm. in terms of a disciplinary proceeding. And, for example, we were talking about just cause before, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. generally unionized workers, if they're going to be disciplined or terminated or whatnot, it's a higher standard the employer is going to have to mm-hmm. hit. And there's going to be more rights those workers have than non-union workers. Mm-hmm. That's just a fact that what stems out of mm-hmm. having a unionized relationship in the workforce.
Especially in an at-will state.
Exactly.
But so, what about the discipline? What about the discipline situation? Can there be a difference in terms of how an employer can discipline a union member versus, generally speaking, union worker versus a non-union?
Generally speaking, if you have a workforce, the same workforce, and it's all within... you know, one group of workers. You don't have a separate bargaining mm-hmm. unit for the
yeah.
union. You have a worker who's a union supporter and another worker who's not a union supporter. That employer has to treat those.
Okay.
Of course, you did mention supervisor.
Right.
It seemed to indicate supervisory versus non-supervisory.
Yes. Yes.
And, of course, there can be differences in disciplinary procedure for a supervisor versus
sure.
somebody that's non-supervisory.
Yeah. Okay.
Union or not.
All right. Let me before we talk to Carol, let me just mention this. For those of you who may be interested in civil harassment restraining orders, and I'm not talking about in the employment situation. I'm talking about a situation where an individual who believes he or she is the victim of civil harassment may seek a temporary restraining order and an injunction prohibiting harassment in our courts. And to learn more about this, there will be a noontime lecture, and this will be a week from today. It'll be on Thursday, February 9th at noon at the San Mateo County Law Library across the street from my building, the Hall of Justice in Redwood City. And attorney Adam Kent, who's a former president of the San Mateo County Bar Association, will be making this presentation. You are invited to attend. It's a free lecture at the Law Library, which is at 710 Hamilton Street in Redwood City, if you'd like some more information about it. And by the way, you can bring your bag lunch or however you have your lunch. You can bring it to the library. If you'd like more information, please call Karen, who is the librarian, Karen Lutke, at 650-363-4913, 650-363-4913. And all right, Carol, thank you for being so patient and waiting. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Welcome.
Hi.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
It's regarding disability. I have medical doctor report, notes, and
I went to supervisor. I have disabilities. So anyway, after that, I was harassed, bullied, retaliated, singled out, you name it. And the last time I was, you know, they sent me home.
You mean they sent you home, they kicked you, they terminated you?
No, they said the word is every time I have a doctor's note with a restrictions of 2 hour typing, they told me always go home. There is no work for you.
Oh.
And as long as you have restrictions, you just stay home, and repeatedly told me to file for EDD. So since September, I don't have an income.
Oh, my. Mm. Wow.
So I'm not sure. So I went to the supervisor and then manager and then compliance and HR, you name it. And the more I was harassed, like a little, you know, like a high school being bullied every time. And then they're always questioning my doctor's note. So I'm not sure if that's allowed. And this is a big company.
Where are you located?
All over.
Don't tell me the name of the company, but where in what city have you been working?
Redwood City. How funny you mentioned that about Karen, and I'm going to call her.
But what city?
Redwood City.
Oh, pardon me. I'm sorry, Redwood
California.
City.
California.
Okay, pardon me.
Redwood City,
oh, sure.
California.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear you. You know, one of the things also that I would like to mention to you before the end of the program, and unfortunately, this program is going much too fast. It really is. You know, in that you are in Redwood City or work in Redwood City, the San Mateo County Bar Association has a lawyer referral service. I suggest that you might want to give a call to it. It's 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149, if you would, Carol, because that's a way to start. Call them, tell them what the problem is, tell them you want to meet with an attorney who represents employees in the work situation. And there are a lot of good attorneys in San Mateo County, and you can start that way. Also, if I may let you all know that if you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. This is a public service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, and for a referral to a lawyer, you can call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. This information is brought to you by the Bar Association of San Francisco and KOW listeners like you. We have half a minute left. Any further comments to Carol at this point?
One thing I would suggest there along the line of speaking to getting additional legal advice is the Employment Law Center. We were talking about that before.
Yes.
They have a clinic called the Workers' Rights Clinic. They have law students working under the supervision of attorneys that do provide free advice, consulting to employees on a whole host of employment law issues. I don't know the phone number off the top of my head.
Well, let me give the website again,
yes.
and Carol can do that. www.las, like in Sam, las-elc.org. And if for some reason, Carol, you don't get that, give me a call at my office tomorrow, and I'll give you the phone number because I deal with them. 650-363-4097. 650-363-4097. We have unfortunately run out of time. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to invite you back. There's just not enough time here to do this. My guests have been employment law attorneys Nina Fendel and Miles Locker. They're the authors of the fourth edition of California Workers' Rights, published by the UC Berkeley Labor Center. My other guest is Malcolm Loungeway, an investigator with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great to have you on the program. Your legal rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McLean. Funding for your legal rights has been made possible by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding has been made available by the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. If you would like to hear about some of the scams and consumer issues that are going on now and how to avoid scams, join me next week. My guest will be Joe Rideout, a consumer advocate with a nonprofit organization, Consumer Action, in San Francisco. Thanks very much for joining us. I'm Chuck Finney.